VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. According to the World Health Organization, diabetes is a chronic metabolic disease characterized by elevated levels of glucose or sugar in the bloodstream. The disease is something they say can lead over time to serious damage to the heart, blood vessels, eyes, kidneys, and nerves. The WHO states diabetes is a major cause of blindness, kidney failure, heart attacks, stroke, and lower limb amputation. It's estimated between 422 to 463 million people throughout the world are living with this disease. November 14th is World Diabetes Day, and the month of November is National Diabetes Month in the United States. The International Diabetes Foundation says the purpose of World Diabetes Day is to focus attention on growing concerns about the worsening health threat posed by this disease. So on today's science edition of Press Conference USA, we'll discuss diabetes, what it is, what causes it, its symptoms, complications, available treatment, and prevention. My guest for today's program is Dr. William Cefalu, MD. Dr. Cefalu is the director of the Division of Diabetes, Endocrinology, and Metabolic Diseases at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, a part of the National Institutes of Health. He joins me today via Skype. Dr. Cefalu, how do you define diabetes?
Diabetes is a disease when your blood sugar, blood glucose, also called the blood sugar, really gets too high. This is a condition that if the blood sugar gets too high and over many years can lead to the complications. And there's really several types of diabetes, but we must recognize that diabetes within each type, there are significant differences. But the vast majority of individuals with diabetes are really classified into one or two broad categories. We refer to those as either type 1 or type 2 diabetes, and I'll define each one of these. Type 1 diabetes, this used to be referred to as juvenile onset diabetes. This is a condition that's generally diagnosed in children and young adults, although it can appear at any age. And if you have type 1, your body really doesn't make insulin. Your immune system essentially has attacked and is destroying cells in your pancreas. That's the organ that makes insulin. So we can characterize type 1 as an absolute or near absolute deficiency of insulin because of destruction of the pancreas. And as a result, individuals when diagnosed with type 1, they need to start on insulin immediately and really remain on insulin for life. Now, type 2 diabetes is the most common form of the disease, and really it accounts for about 90 to 95% of diagnosed cases. And this type of diabetes occurs most often in middle age and older people, and it's generally associated with obesity. It causes a condition we could talk about later called insulin resistance, but the bottom line is that your body is not efficient in using insulin. So if you have type 2, your body does not make or use insulin well. So initially at diagnosis, individuals with type 2 may make insulin and can actually be controlled on nutrition and oral medication, but over time, it's inadequate to meet the body's needs. So they may proceed to combination therapy or, for that matter, for insulin. Now, the risk factors for developing type 2 is older age, obesity, you could have a family history, history of gestational diabetes, and really physical inactivity. So type 2 occurs at higher rates also among racial and ethnic minority populations. And we're also seeing a disturbing trend that type 2 can appear at any age, particularly now occurring in childhood. There are other less common forms of diabetes. Again, gestational diabetes is a diabetes that develops in women during their pregnancy, and they're classified as having gestational. More times than not, it may resolve after the baby is born, but they have a higher risk of developing type 2, 5 to 10 years after giving birth. And then there are other rare and atypical cases, which we can talk about later. But the bottom line is that type 1 and type 2 are the major classes of diabetes.
And you mentioned insulin in describing diabetes. Could you please explain the role insulin plays in the human body?
Insulin is the major hormone that controls blood glucose throughout the body. It is produced by the pancreas, and even 24 hours a day, insulin is produced in low levels to maintain our metabolism. At mealtime, as we eat a meal and calories come in through the gastrointestinal system, that stimulates insulin to be released at mealtime. So you actually produce insulin 24 hours a day. It's a hormone that's needed for normal glucose metabolism. And at mealtimes, the insulin goes up to drive the glucose into the cells. Now, this is important because you actually have these increases in insulin during the day with mealtime. So this is important when we talk about insulin therapy. Insulin replacement therapy, now there's a number of formulations in which they're either short-acting insulin or ultra-fast-acting insulin that's really responsive after mealtimes. And then you have insulin medications that last over 24 hours. So you have this basal or this constant insulin being produced 24 hours a day. And then what we have this bolus insulin that's produced at mealtime. And actually, if you want to replace insulin in an individual, you'll try to have a combination of these type of insulin formulations that give you 24-hour coverage and then coverage at mealtime. And this is really the advantage of like the insulin pump, that we can do this with technology.
Doctor, just how common is diabetes among the world's population? I understand it's a growing problem.
Well, it is a huge problem. And the estimates from the International Diabetes Federation suggested that in 2019, over 460 million adults were living with diabetes. Now, the concern is that the projection by 2045, this will rise to 700 million. And that's, again, data from the International Diabetes Federation. In the United States, it's been estimated that we have about 34 million people, or really 13% of the adult population, that have diabetes. And really, the worry is that 88 million have prediabetes, and because it's an asymptomatic disease, they do not know they have prediabetes. So this is a growing problem and a growing burden around the world.
And I understand that this year's focus from the NIDDK for National Diabetes Month is on prediabetes and preventing diabetes. What can people diagnosed with this condition do to prevent it from becoming full-blown diabetes? Any tips?
Yes. In fact, we have a lot of information on prevention of type 2. And importantly, since you have a global audience, let me just state that the good news is that by making healthy lifestyle changes, it is possible to prevent and delay prediabetes. And I will say that because we have numerous landmark studies, not only in the United States, but around the globe, in Finland and China and India, that have shown that these lifestyle changes, and I won't go into the specific studies, but the important point here is that in countries and cultures around the world, we have shown conclusively that preventive strategies using either lifestyle modification or various pharmacologic interventions can delay or prevent type 2 in high-risk individuals. For example, a landmark study in the United States, the Diabetes Prevention Program, showed that after only 2.8 years of lifestyle intervention, you can reduce and delay the onset of diabetes by 58%. Again, a Finnish study after 4 years showed this can be reduced also by 58%, but studies have been done in China and in India showing that lifestyle intervention clearly can delay the onset of diabetes. So the question you ask is, what can be done? Well, we clearly know that some of the modifiable risk factors, obesity and sedentary lifestyle, and this is the cornerstone of prevention. First of all, just recognizing that you have prediabetes, and then some modest weight loss. In many of these studies, the goal was 5 to 7% of losing weight can dramatically decrease your risk of developing diabetes. So we know in clinical centers what it takes to prevent diabetes. And that's the important point your audience should know, that global studies have shown that we can prevent the progression to type 2 diabetes.
So, doctor, what are the symptoms for diabetes and prediabetes? What should people be looking for?
The symptoms, let's talk about the symptoms for diabetes first. First of all, if you have overt diabetes because of the elevated blood sugar, you may have increased thirst, you may have increased urination, hunger, fatigue, blurred vision. You may even have some numbness or tingling in the hands and feet. That means that if you have those symptoms, you most likely have diabetes, and that needs to be tested by your healthcare provider. However, other symptoms, if you have symptoms of type 1, remember, this is the diabetes in which the pancreas becomes destroyed and lack of a key hormone, insulin. You may have these symptoms presenting in literally weeks. But the symptoms of type 2 often develop so slowly, and they actually may go over many years. The patient may not even notice them. Again, they may feel that this tiredness or fatigue may be attributed to aging. So it's very important that you be screened for diabetes. So again, what we recommend is that if you should be tested, if you're an adult and if you're either overweight or obese and you have some of the risk factors, that you be tested. For example, if you have a first degree relative with diabetes or you're in high risk ethnic group. Also, if you have a history of cardiovascular disease or heart disease, if you have high blood pressure or on treatment for high blood pressure, or if your good cholesterol, the so-called low the HDL is low, those are all risk factors for diabetes. So the important thing is obesity, physical activity, older age, family history. You clearly should be tested.
Are these symptoms you described, doctor, common among all three types of diabetes?
Well, the major types of diabetes, what we were talking about, are type 1 and type 2. But yes, the elevated blood sugar, the increased urination, the hunger, you could see these common symptoms among diabetes. But I wouldn't rely, these are symptoms that suggest the disease is present. But the important thing, as I mentioned, many people with prediabetes do not know they have it. It may be completely asymptomatic. So it's important to recognize if you have these risk factors, as I mentioned, that you should be periodically tested with your healthcare provider. So this is where prevention is needed, and a heightened awareness of diabetes needs to be addressed.
Doctor, early in our conversation, you were talking about type 1 diabetes, formerly being referred to as juvenile onset diabetes. So I'm taking it that very young people can get this disease. What about type 2 diabetes? I understand from recent studies that more and more young people are developing type 2 diabetes. And you had described earlier that mostly middle-aged people age, tend to be patients of diabetes. What do you think about the cause of why more young people are developing type 2?
Well, we are seeing more young people develop type 2 diabetes. And again, it's related to a lot of the modifiable factors, but there are other factors that we need to know more about. We do know that type 2 that presents in youth and adolescents, it appears to be a different disease than what we see in adults. There are some studies that have done that have suggested that some of the common medications that we use in adulthood, when used in youth and adolescents with type 2, they don't seem to respond as well to the medications. In fact, it appears to be a more aggressive disease. They develop these complications. The complications of diabetes are what we refer to as the damage that occurs because of the elevated blood sugar over years. And again, the eye disease leading to blindness, heart disease leading to heart attacks. We're talking about neuropathy leading to amputation. So for that matter, the kidney disease, we're seeing these complications appear early in youth and adolescents that develop these complications, so that develop diabetes. So it's interesting that we think that type 2 in youth and adolescents is a more aggressive disease. And this is data that really we begin to appreciate over the last decade or so.
Let's take a break. This is the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. You can get in touch with us through either Facebook at VOA Current Affairs or Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or just send an email to us at PCUSA@VOANews.com. We're marking World Diabetes Day with a discussion about a disease that affects an estimated 422 to 463 million people worldwide. My guest is Dr. William Cefalu, MD, Director of the Division of Diabetes, Endocrinology, and Metabolic Diseases at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, a part of the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Cefalu, how is diabetes diagnosed and typed?
Diabetes can be actually diagnosed three different ways, and each way measures glucose in a certain level. For example, there's a test that everyone really needs to know about, and this is called the hemoglobin A1C test. And this is important because the test is called glycated hemoglobin. Glycate means glucose, and hemoglobin is the major protein in the red blood cells that carries the oxygen. So this protein actually stays around. I mean, the red blood cells stay around 2 or 3 months. So by measuring glucose on this red blood cell, hemoglobin, you can get an overall assessment of blood sugar control over the previous 2 or 3 months. So the important thing here, this test is called A1C or hemoglobin A1C. And the real benefit of it is you can get this test anytime. And this test is not dependent on whether you've eaten or you're fasted. It is a test that measures glucose the previous 2 or 3 months. So this normal test is a percent, and normal is considered less than 5.7%. What is considered prediabetes is 5.7 to 6.4. And diabetes is diagnosed when this test is 6.5% or higher. So that's the first test, and that's an accepted test. And this is a test that your healthcare provider can provide. And again, the benefits of this, you don't have to fast, and it's indicative of glucose control over the previous couple of months. Now, any test that you get will probably need to be confirmed a second time. The second test is the fasting blood glucose test. And again, this is a test. Fasting means not having to eat anything or drink overnight for at least 8 hours. And so this test is done first thing in the morning. And this actually measures your blood glucose at the time of the testing. Now, normal in the United States is considered less than 100. Prediabetes is considered 100 to 125, and a blood sugar of 126 milligrams per deciliter or higher is considered diabetes. So fasting glucose and A1C. Now there's a third test, a little bit more involved, called the oral glucose tolerance test. And oral glucose means that you actually drink a solution. It's like a meal test, and you're glucose is measured at 2 hours to determine if you have diabetes. So at 2 hours, if your 2 hour meal test is less than 140, that's normal. Prediabetes is 140 to 200, and any glucose at 2 hours after meal is diagnosed at 200. The important thing here is that if you do have someone who is symptomatic and they go into their doctor and they get a random glucose, that random blood glucose over 200 is highly indicative of diabetes. So the question of diagnosis, A1C test, fasting blood glucose test, oral glucose tolerance test, each of their parameters, and then finally, any random glucose over 200 is highly, highly indicative of having diabetes. If you can control the A1C, to what we feel to be a near normal level, the lower the A1C, the lower the risk of complications. So this has been the definitive test in clinical studies that have demonstrated conclusively that glucose control matters. If your A1C is 9 to 10%, that is really poor control. But again, we have evidence from around the world that controlling this test, which is indicative of glucose control, is needed to reduce what we refer to as the small vessel complications, eye, kidney, and nerve disease, and the large vessel or large blood vessel disease, heart disease, and stroke.
Doctor, is diabetes curable?
At this point, we can delay or prevent the onset of diabetes with the type 2. Prevention studies from around the world have indicated we can significantly delay the onset of diabetes. In fact, some of the data from the diabetes prevention program here in the United States have shown that this intervention with a common medication, metformin, which is available around the world, or for that matter, with lifestyle, this 2.8 years of intervention actually showed effect 15 years later. So we have evidence that we can significantly delay the onset of the disease. Now, we also have some evidence that if you already have diabetes with significant weight loss, or for that matter, with some metabolic surgery procedures, we can actually reverse diabetes for a while in those individuals. So we have good evidence that we can delay the onset of diabetes, whether it can be prevented forever. Right now, we are going on scientific evidence that we can delay the disease for a significant period of time. But the exciting news we have now actually has to do with type 1. Type 1 diabetes starts with immune destruction of the pancreas. You develop antibodies against the pancreas, and you don't secrete this incredibly important hormone that's really required for life. And really, what has been a paradigm change over the past decade or so is that type 1 diabetes actually begins before the glucose even becomes abnormal. We know that individuals with type 1 may have this genetic risk, and there's actually a genotype, a certain gene pattern called the HLA genotype. It means that you're genetically predisposed to develop type 1. And then something triggers the body to where you start developing these proteins to start attacking the pancreas. And these proteins, these are antibodies. You know, antibodies are what we create to fight infection, but they can also do harm to the body by attacking the body's own tissues. So we recognize that type 1, once you start developing these antibodies to your pancreas, once you develop two antibodies, you may have no symptoms whatsoever. But that's where the disease starts. It's called stage 1. So you can have two antibodies by blood testing be completely asymptomatic. Then it's not a matter of if you can develop diabetes, it's probably when. But then you start developing some glucose abnormalities that's not diabetes, but again, abnormal glucose. And by the time you're diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, that's stage 3. We now have data from several years ago, the first data ever, that we can delay the onset of type 1 with this drug, tocilizumab. It's a drug that was tested in a study called TrialNet, an NIDDK study. And basically, we were able to delay the onset of type 1, the first time this has been shown at an early stage of diabetes before clinical symptoms. It was delayed by 2 or more years among people who are at high risk. So I just find this is a remarkable finding. And what this means really is simply this. If you're diagnosed with type 1, you have to take insulin for life. You have to start then. You have to check your blood sugar levels. That starts the clock to controlling your blood glucose and preventing complications. So if you can delay type 1, phenomenal study. That means that 2 years, that individual does not need to take insulin.
Dr. Cefalu, you were talking about ways of treating diabetes. I understand, along with diabetes management, that certain medications are used to help treat type 2 in particular diabetes. What types or classes of medications are used to treat diabetes?
Yes, this is where it's also exciting. We talked a lot about insulin for use for type 1. But for type 2, there's also been some incredible breakthroughs. Right now, if you have type 2 diabetes, what has been the real change over the past many years is that we've had the development of these two classes of medications, the GLP-1 receptor agonists and a class called the SGLT2 inhibitors. The important thing here, these are agents that were shown to reduce blood glucose, but they had added effects. They had minimal effects on hypoglycemia. They had weight loss effects. And in clinical studies, they actually had effects to protect the heart, effects to protect the kidney. So these two classes of drugs, really over the past 5 years, have really changed the way we now manage type 2. So if you have type 2, in the past, we have had agents called sulfonylureas, which increase the secretion of insulin from the pancreas. We have metformin, which helps sensitize the body to insulin. We have insulin use. We have other agents called DPP-4 inhibitors, which also help release insulin. And these two new classes of medications. What is recommended now is that because heart disease is such an important complication for those with type 2, that a few years ago, we would use these agents if you had an indication of heart disease and your blood sugar was at a certain level. Now, these agents are being considered if you have diabetes, regardless of what the blood sugar level is. But you begin to add these medications. We know that type 2, again, you may be controlled initially because you do make insulin, but it may not be working as well. So you may start with metformin, or you may start with one of these other agents. But given the natural history of type 2, the pancreas continues to fail. You're going to have to mix and match and add additional medications to control the blood sugar. Right now, the decision of what initial medication you use, looking at the algorithm, the standards of care, you would look, first of all, if you have diabetes, do you have a high risk or established heart disease or kidney disease? If you do, then your healthcare provider may prescribe one of these two new agents along with metformin. But you may have a problem where you particularly have low blood sugar, in which case two of these classes may be used. Another agent called an insulin sensitizer may be used, a DPP-4. We have agents that have minimal effects on hypoglycemia. Then what if you have issues with weight gain? There are agents that we would suggest based on that. And we also know that cost is a factor, so that is also an issue. But we do have a wonderful arsenal of medications to use and to use in the right cases to get control of the blood glucose. What we recognize now is that the patient should be at the center of care, and the patient should have input into what these medications do, how they work, and so there should be a nice dialogue between the physician and the patient.
Dr. William Cefalu, I really appreciate you joining us today and talking to us about diabetes and diabetes prevention and treatment.
Well, thank you very much, sir. Really appreciate it.
That was Dr. William Cefalu, MD. He is the director of the Division of Diabetes, Endocrinology, and Metabolic Diseases at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, a part of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Cefalu joined us today via Skype. If you'd like to learn more about diabetes, check out nidk.nih.gov/health-information/diabetes. And that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. Thank you for listening today. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.